may not be aware of this, but the Issues Etc., this program has a twofold purpose. We don't say this often enough, but it's true. The twofold purpose of Issues Etc. is first, to teach and defend the truth rediscovered in the 16th century Lutheran Reformation, that is, justification by grace alone, through faith alone, for the sake of Christ alone. And the second is to challenge the culture's, postmodern culture's, illogical and unbiblical ideologies. Now, in order to do that, you've got to take a look at postmodern culture. You've got to know what it is that you're examining, what it is you're critiquing, what it is you're living in. One of the realities of postmodern culture here in America is a little thing called reality TV. We're going to be talking about that during the first half hour of Issues Etc., finding out what exactly it is, what's the common denominator in all these things that build themselves as reality programming, and what's it doing to us? Why do we have it? Why has it taken over? And just lately, I read someone, a media critic say, look, reality TV has taken over and the sitcom is on its way out. It's had a pretty good run, but it's over with now. Goodbye, I Love Lucy. Hello, Survivor. I hope not. I hope not. We'll be talking about that in the first half hour of Issues Etc. Later in the hour, we'll be joined by David Osteen, Executive Director of National Right to Life, based in Washington, D.C. We'll talk about the current and future makeup of the U.S. Supreme Court. If you were reading Time magazine, the latest issue, there's a headline, Bush's Supreme Challenge, with a court retirement likely. Al Gonzalez is a Bush favorite, but is that enough? The story now is that we might have two retirements before the next term of the Supreme Court. We'll find out how likely that is and what this challenge is for the president who will appoint men or women to fill those seats. And a little later in the program, Ed Simkowiak, National Director of Stop Planned Parenthood International, based in Stafford, Virginia, will join us to talk about Planned Parenthood and abortion and their money. That's all followed by open lines for your questions and your comments. I want to talk about two things. First of all, I read a St. Louis Post-Dispatch article a couple days ago having to do with a Roman Catholic elementary school, and I think I'm getting this right, that wanted to unionize its teachers, or the teachers wanted to unionize. A little, collective bargaining. What do you think of unions? Are unions a Christian, non-Christian issue? Or is it a matter of pure politics? And during open lines, you may have been reading about, well, certainly you've heard about, the challenge to keep law and order in Iraq. We've gone through one provisional governor, now we've got another one ready to go. Now they're talking about confiscating firearms from the populace. A sheikh in Iraq said, look, we'll hand over our guns. He collected a bunch of them, he handed them over. It was considered a good move. And he's encouraging all Iraqis to hand over their guns. And at first glance, you're going to say, hey, that's a good idea. That's something that's necessary. But is that inconsistent with someone who says, but I want to keep my guns? In Iraq, they got to hand theirs over to have law and order. But to have law and order here, I got to be able to keep mine. We'll talk about that during open lines. Our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Dr. Richard Winter is an associate professor of practical theology at Covenant Theological Seminary here in St. Louis, and he is author of the new book titled Still Bored in a Culture of Entertainment. Dr. Winter, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thank you, Todd.
These reality programs, they've been around for a couple of years now. Survivor, we have the latest that just got over with was Mr. Personality. They're all called reality TV. What do all of them, regardless of how they package themselves, have in common?
Well, Todd, as I've thought about this, and I've so struggled to come up with formulating what I think about them, but that the word reality really strikes me, and I think there's something to do with a real hunger and longing for reality in the human heart. And when people live cut off from God's reality and live in the entertainment culture, and that's part of the argument in my book, is that living on the entertainment culture with just surfing the web or the internet or whatever ultimately separates you from reality and from relationships. It's sort of like a drug, and it leaves you more dissatisfied and with a deeper boredom in life. And inevitably, when that happens, you have a hunger for reality. And I think actually you see that coming out in reality TV, that people have a hunger for a reality that is unscripted and authentic. You know, it's not paid actors, it's not Hollywood stars, it's people like us. They have a hunger for real situations of conflict, of competition, of difficult choices. You know, what would I do in that sort of situation? They have a hunger for feeling real emotions, which maybe in the mundaneness of ordinary life, they don't feel a whole range of emotions. They get sort of numbed by just watching too much TV of other sorts. And then I think there's also a real hunger for real relationships, you know, of hunger for real relationships in their own lives. And sadly, I think people often have more real relationships with the people on reality TV. You know, they root for them, they vote for them, they laugh with them, they are afraid with them. There's something in all of our hearts that without God, we have a desperate desire to be known more deeply. So I think these are some of the threads that I see tying these things together, just a hunger, a longing for reality.
Is reality TV a genuine answer to that hunger, or is it just more entertainment?
It's a bit of both, I think. It does actually, there's a sense in which, you know, it is people that you're watching people who are partially scripted, you know, the place, the situation, the events, it's heavily edited. So there's obviously, it's not totally unscripted, but you are seeing people in authentic situations, so that it does reveal the human heart, and the extremes of both dignity and depravity. It brings out all those things in a real way, because these are real people that you're watching. And yet, I think it doesn't enable us to relate perhaps better or even more deeply to real people around us. And certainly, unless God is in the picture, obviously, it's just a two-dimensional, as it were, rather than a three-dimensional reality that one's living in.
One of the things that I find intriguing about the scenario of a family sitting down in the evening watching their mm-hmm. favorite reality TV program mm-hmm. is that they are going to the TV, to that medium, for their reality, when sitting next to them on the couch or across from them in the living room is their real family.
That's right.
There is reality there, but in escaping to the reality of reality TV, it's a desire to live a vicarious reality rather than the one that God's put us in.
Yeah, again, it's a mixture, and that's why I have a hard time, you know, condemning it completely, because someone said, I think I read the other day, that this is one of the programs that a whole family will watch together, and they will get involved in together, and they will vote for American Idol together, you know. So it actually draws the family together in a competitive, fun, interesting environment where they do still relate to each other. They're not just sitting dumbly uninvolved with each other. So it's partially good, but you're right. There is a sort of vicarious, and each show varies, of course. Some are a whole lot better than others. I mean, when you go to some of the reality things like The Manor House and Frontier House way back, those were entertaining and educational. But when you get to American Idol and Fear Factor and Joe Millionaire, you know, you're going down a certain scale here, less value to them.
Now, you've raised something there, and there is obviously a continuum in what we would call, what we're going to define as reality TV, from the things like, you say, Frontier House, which is a far more... real, I hate to use the word because it just sounds trite, but a far more real situation than mm-hmm. the contrived in-studio kind of thing. I'd even put the Osbournes over there on the end with Frontier House. I mean, at least they just let the cameras roll no matter what was happening.
Yeah.
And people would like it or not like it. But at the same time, is on that continuum, is there also kind of a compression continuum? In other words, what Mr. Personality does, or Who Wants to Marry a Millionaire does, is take a real situation and compress it into the confines of the TV medium, and it becomes distorted. Whereas it's a little less compressed, or maybe a lot less compressed, in something like Frontier House, where people are just out there working their tail off to survive, and the camera just so happens to be there.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. I think it does compress it. You get much more of a sense of long-term relationships, long-term struggles in the Frontier House or something like that over time. And the other is, you're right, compression's a good word, I think. And it gives you a sort of distorted view of reality and the way relationships grow and change. And it's highly edited and manipulated for us. It's a manipulated reality, isn't it?
Is there something of the celebrity culture that plays into this as well? You mentioned before that these are ordinary people, but sometimes put into extraordinary circumstances. Have we become tired of watching people who are paid to read lines and paid very well to read lines and depict reality?
Yeah. Well, I think that's the attraction of these characters. You know, on American Idol, it could be any one of us. And the possibility of fame and stardom, and this perhaps goes to another deeper hunger that we all have for significance and status in life. We want to make a mark. We want to be famous because we see the successful people as being the Hollywood celebrities. And it gets into the range for us if these ordinary people in front of us can do this. So I think, yes, there is a sort of reaction against Hollywood stardom and this desire for more reality, more possibilities for us.
We're talking about reality TV. Dr. Richard Winter, author of the book Still Bored in a Culture of Entertainment, is our guest. He's also associate professor of practical theology at Covenant Theological Seminary here in St. Louis. If you'd like to join us with a question or a comment, our call-in numbers are 505-7850. Or 1-800-730-2727. Beyond the simple observations that you have been making here, Dr. Winter, what are the dangers of reality TV as now a fixture in our culture?
Well, I don't know that it is a fixture. Well, I think some of it will remain, but I think people, it'll be hard to match the interest and the sort of the newness of the reality TV. I don't know how long it'll last. Even Time magazine today has come out with an article saying that there are going to be more sitcoms next season and less reality TV. But I think that one of the dangers is that, you know, you have to hype the situation each time. It's intended to thrill, to scare, to arouse, to excite, to shock, to arouse strong emotions of whether it's sexual, whether it's anger, whether it's jealousy, disgust, fear, joy, and I think it's, you know, each time, maybe, and this is again what I argue in my book on boredom and the culture of entertainment, that it becomes like a drug fix. You need more to entertain you, to excite you, to grab your interest each time, and the ordinary things of life become mundane and boring, and it's harder for us to live with those. And I think that's where it's just wanting exciting things all the time. That's a real danger, I think, that we lose the wonder of living with the ordinary things of God's creation and the slow pace of life, of most of our lives. You see in nature much more of those rhythms of the slow changes that occur. And that's how we grow and we change as people, too. These reality TV things, I think, lead to much faster expectations of change and of fame and of significance and excitement.
And of gratification, I'm wondering about, you mentioned American Idol several times, but I have an 11-year-old daughter. She's a huge fan of American Idol.
Yeah.
And, of course, we're right at the cliffhanging moment.
Yeah.
Of American Idol tonight. Tonight is the night when we decide, America decides, who's going to be the next American Idol. And yet it has really only, for these people, been less than a year. They have been, whoever does win and those who don't win also win because they go on to careers as well, have really been, through a process of selection, catapulted into the public eye and into celebrity without, as they used to say in the music business, earning their chops or mm-hmm. or earning their stripes.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems as though we are told then, look, gratification does not have to be delayed or even worked for.
That's very true, and I think that's a huge problem with our culture, is the instant gratification, the instant excitement, just surf the channel for the next thing that grabs your attention. And most things that deeply satisfy are the things you work for over many years. But some of these people have cultivated gifts of music or singing and worked at them. And what's perhaps, what's intriguing to me is that in these situations, although they've been catapulted into stardom, we're intrigued by how they deal with that very thing, how they deal with the fame. And we see their reactions to it, how people deal with Simon Cowell telling them they're the worst singer in the world, and how they react to that. That's the intrigue of it, I think, that grabs our attention. How do people relate to these extreme situations? What would I do in a situation like that? How would I react? I think that's why it sort of grabs us.
One of the things that intrigues and grabs me, too, is, and again with reference to American Idol, the sense of entitlement that the average person then gains. There were people who tried out, you know, they cover all of the tryouts. There are people who tried out who would stand there with a straight face and no talent.
Ah, I know.
I'm sounding like Simon Cowell, saying, I am the next American Idol, almost with the sense of entitlement that if you don't let me through, you are robbing me of what is rightfully mine because I saw someone else do it last year.
Yes, exactly. Oh, it's amazing. And that's the fascination, is that you're seeing people in unscripted situations where you don't know how they're going to react. It's completely spontaneous. And are they going to break down and weep and run off the stage shouting? Are they going to just proclaim, I'm the best in the world, and you just can't see it? You're wrong. It's just, that's, I think, is a fascinating phenomenon. It's sort of human nature with all its dignity and depravity unveiled. And obviously you see the worst of the depravity bits in sort of Jerry Springer-type shows. But in some of the aspects of American Idol, you see great dignity in people. The fact they can treat people with respect, they can deal with celebrity with dignity and doesn't go to their head.
Is reality TV good for us, Dr. Winter?
Oh, gosh, that history will tell on that one, won't it? Is it any worse for us than sitcoms? My concern often over television is not, I mean, it's partly what you're watching, but it's partly what we could be doing when we're not watching. And what we miss out on in the rest of life in terms of talking to each other over a meal table, of reading books, of being out in nature, of developing hobbies, things that aren't the instant gratification culture. And we just get used to sitting on the couch every evening watching TV, and that's all we do. And our brains and hearts atrophy and harden, I think, and we get cut off from God's reality. So I, in the long run, it's a mixture, as most of these things are. There's some good, some bad in them.
Why are we bored, not only with what we see on TV by way of our entertainment, but even with our own reality? Why would we rather sit and be bored by what is coming out of the TV than be bored with the people sitting next to us in our own family? I mean, if they're both boring, it seems a toss-up.
Yeah. Well, I think it takes effort and energy to move out and take an interest in other people and in God's world. We are basic, fundamentally pretty self-centered people, and we go for pleasure, we go for our own self-satisfaction, and we live in a world where self-fulfillment is the order of the day. And you have to sacrifice something to give to other people. But spend an evening working in a shelter and contrast that with what you experience afterwards and what you've given, and spend an evening watching reality TV and how you feel afterwards, and I guarantee there'll be a pretty profound difference. Giving yourself to other people, being involved in the real world, is deeply more satisfying in the long run.
What does reality TV as a phenomenon in the entertainment culture say about American culture in general? I guess I'm kind of asking you to speculate as to what history will say about American culture during the era of reality TV.
Mm-hmm. Well, it seems to be another symptom of a postmodern generation which has cut itself off from God, which is saying we don't know what reality is. We can't define it scientifically exactly. That's the modern world we used to live in. We create our own reality. And this is just another example of a sort of experimenting with reality, manipulating reality, creating situations where people do horrible things or wonderful things. And maybe, again, I come back to what I began with, that it's that sort of deep hunger for something real beyond appearances. And we live in a world where everything is judged by appearances. And I think maybe people looking back will, hopefully, if we long for a return, people returning to the truth of a relationship with God and what his reality is and living in that, that we will see it just as one of the many symptoms of the postmodern subjective era in which we live, where everything depends on feelings and appearance.
With only a minute before we go, Dr. Winter, how can Christians living in this culture use reality TV as a possible opportunity to witness to Jesus Christ?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think I would come back to the theme I began with of, you know, relating to people where their hunger is, where they have longings for something more in life. Feel this sort of feeling that there's an emptiness, and over time, as you live alongside people maybe who watch a lot of reality TV, being able to talk to them about what is reality, you know. Is it just living from day to day with going to work and watching TVs and going to movies? Or is there something more that we're made for? And I think, you know, if we're open to that and keep relationships with people and are willing to talk to them, there will be opportunities to share the gospel and the good news of God's reality with them.
Dr. Richard Winter, thank you very much for being our guest on Issues Etc.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Todd. Thank you.
Dr. Richard Winter is Associate Professor of Practical Theology at Covenant Theological Seminary in St. Louis. He's authored this book called Still Bored in a Culture of Entertainment. When we come back from this break, we'll be spending some time talking about the current and future makeup of the U.S. Supreme Court. Time magazine says it's a real possibility that there will be two open seats between this and the next session, the Chief Justice and perhaps the other candidate is Sandra Day O'Connor. And the president may have, well, not an unparalleled opportunity, but not an unexpected opportunity to appoint two Supreme Court justices. We'll talk about whether or not they will be pro-life and whether it's even possible, given the current state of the Senate, to get a pro-life Supreme Court nominee through. David Osteen will join us. He's Executive Director of National Right to Life, based in Washington, D.C. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Can God affect a spiritual change through a physical means? Can God's spoken word, holy baptism, and the Lord's Supper really deliver the benefits of Jesus' death and resurrection? How can these concrete means of grace be the center of one's spiritual life? The answers to these questions are found in the new Issues Etc. Book of the Month for May, The Spirituality of the Cross by Dr. Jean Edward Veith. You can order The Spirituality of the Cross online at issuesetc.org. Click on the What's New section and you'll find information on this book, issuesetc.org, or call Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040, or issuesetc.org.
Now this Global Minute lets you hear that a world crisis gives Christians more chances to share Christ. Ron Nicholas is president of Educational Services International, and he says they're sending Christians to teach English to refugees living in the country of Hungary.
People have had to flee from Afghanistan, Iran, Iraq, and Sudan to escape some of the Muslim extremists and pressures that have been put upon them. And that's opened an opportunity for people like yourself to go to Hungary, a very peaceful, neutral country, and have the chance to share your life and your faith through teaching English to these people.
Pray for Christians to use their skills in teaching so others can hear about Christ. Learn more by calling ESI at 1-800-895-7955 or on the internet at teachoverseas.org. That's teachoverseas.org.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. James Baldwin wrote, "Children have never been good at listening to their elders, but they have never failed to imitate them." For sure. Prosecutors filed charges against 15 Chicago area high school seniors for viciously hazing juniors. One cause was a parent who illegally supplied the kids with a keg of beer. In another Chicago area incident, young people broke into and trashed a home while the owners were away. Children learn what they live, is the old adage. So the obvious moral for parents is to examine the lifestyle they are modeling for their children. But what about young parents, like the keg providers, or the ones who did not teach respect for property? Parents convinced at that moment that their modeling is good for their impressionable children. And what hope is there for the older person who realizes too late the error of earlier parenting ways? To tell you the truth, I'm not sure. But I do draw one conclusion. We adults need to scrutinize our behavior daily. If you are interested, read the Old Testament prophets. They won't exonerate all your ways.
Concordia Seminary in St. Louis is pleased to announce its 2003 Summer Carillon Recital Series. Guests are invited to bring lawn chairs, blankets, and picnics to enjoy in the main quad or on the seminary grounds near Luther's statue. The concerts will be presented each Tuesday evening in June from 7 to 8 p.m. Concordia Seminary is located at 801 DeMunn Avenue in Clayton. For more information about the 2003 Summer Carillon Recital Series, contact Concordia Seminary. Welcome back to Issues Etc. We had planned to talk about the Supreme Court, and that's what I had teased before the break. We were going to change the schedule around a little bit and spend some time talking about Planned Parenthood and the abortion issue with Ed Simkoviak. He's National Director of Stop Planned Parenthood International, based in Stafford, Virginia. If you'd like to join us, we have those call-in numbers, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. And open lines will follow a little bit later. Just a reminder, we will be talking about two things. First of all, unions. Trade unions and labor unions. Is this an issue upon which God's Word has anything to say? A Catholic elementary school, you may have read about this in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, their teachers are thinking about unionizing, a little collective bargaining. Is that wrong? Or, on the other hand, are unions really the more virtuous way of relating to our employers? We'll talk about it during open lines. Oh, the other thing I wanted to talk about during open lines, and I mentioned this before, and that is the disarmament that's taking place in Iraq. I'm not talking about weapons of mass destruction. I'm talking about getting the guns, the AK-47s, the handguns, whatever, the hunting rifles, out of the hands of the average Iraqi. You may have been amazed to see how many people have guns over there. It is a gun culture. There's no two ways about it. I don't know how Saddam Hussein stayed in power. Everybody was armed, and yet they lived in tyranny. But now it's causing a problem. And the latest American retired general who's over there trying to keep peace says, look, we're just going to have to confiscate the firearms. In some cases, those who are trying to keep the peace are outgunned. Now, I know that Christians are keen on the issue of gun control. Some of them are. The gun control should be kept at a minimum. This is gun control at its maximum. Just taking the guns out of the people's hands against their will. Is it a good idea? Is it a bad idea? Why in Iraq and not here? We'll talk about it during Open Lines. Ed Simkoviak is National Director of Stop Planned Parenthood International, based in Stafford, Virginia. Planned Parenthood just made $1 billion on abortion, according to a recent study. We'll find out about that. Ed Simkoviak, welcome to Issues Etc.
Well, thank you, Pastor Todd. It's a pleasure to be here.
Tell us about this $1 billion mark that has been passed by Planned Parenthood.
Well, we're getting close to $1 billion. The way it is we're saying it's getting close. We have the records back to 1977 of the number of abortions that they've performed, which totals 3,019,559, their own statements. And what we've done is we've looked at these abortions throughout the years, and we've multiplied each year's abortion numbers by an average cost for the abortion in that particular year. So, for example, in the latest year, based upon the information that we have from Planned Parenthood's website, Planned Parenthood got about $375 per abortion. So you multiply that by the 213,026 abortions that they did in 2001, and you get $80 million of income from abortion in just 1 year. Now you repeat that process for the years going back to 1977, and you come up with the staggering number that there is 894 million of estimated total abortion income from Planned Parenthood from 1977 to 2001. Obviously, we don't have the numbers back to 1973, and of course, we're not totaling up the numbers for 2002 yet, which haven't come in from Planned Parenthood. So when we consider the fact that income from Planned Parenthood's abortion in 2002 will probably be at least $80 million again, that's where we come up with the almost $1 billion now.
What does this figure tell you? I mean, just beyond just the raw income level of Planned Parenthood, for abortions, not for other services, but for abortions, what does it tell you?
Well, of course, it tells us that abortion is a huge part of Planned Parenthood's business, and I don't think they're going to deny that. I mean, they're very proud of the abortion numbers that they actually post on their website, and they even put in their annual report. I think that when you look at these numbers, what it tells me is that people need to realize that Planned Parenthood, in addition to this abortion income, is also getting their tax dollars. Tax dollars going to Planned Parenthood from the federal, state, and local government are roughly 32% of Planned Parenthood's income over the years 1987 to 2002. In the most recent year, it was 35% of Planned Parenthood's income. So what we need to do is we need to say, my tax dollars are supporting this organization that's doing all these abortions. And you have to say, I'm going to talk to my elected representatives, write to my elected representatives at the federal, state, and even, yes, the local, city, or county government level, and inform them that I don't want my tax dollars going to an organization that's killed so many babies every year. And that's the simple top-down approach that we have to have. Now, there's a grassroots approach, which I'm willing to talk about as well, but from the top down, we got to cut out that money.
Well, before we talk about the grassroots approach, let's talk about, in essence, defunding Planned Parenthood, at least with regard to the tax revenue that they're able to pull from the federal government. How would that be done?
Well, the main thing would be to eliminate Title X. The Title X is the it's about 33-year-old program now. It's the granddaddy of all these programs that are funding Planned Parenthood. And it's the single largest federal program which is funding Planned Parenthood. So that would be the top of the wish list. Planned Parenthood also gets a significant amount of money from Medicaid to have a clause in the Medicaid which would basically say that Medicaid would not go to any organization that performs surgical abortion would be a way that you could eliminate funding of Planned Parenthood via Medicaid. But right now, I think that the focus should be on Title X. That's a doable project, I think, and it would cut a big chunk of Planned Parenthood's government funding out. Now, we also have a lot of battles going around on the state level, where basically the states are, people, pro-lifers in the states are trying to basically say, look, any organization that gets our that's doing abortions is not going to get our tax dollars. Okay, it's a simple thing. And there's fights going on in various legislatures around the country on various versions of that basic idea. But that's what we got to do. We have to ask our state legislature not to give any funds to, and you don't have to be specific to Planned Parenthood. You simply have to say to any organization that does abortions. And of course, that's going to cover Planned Parenthood.
And the grassroots approach that you mentioned before?
Well, the grassroots approach relies on people taking up the battle in their own communities, especially those communities that have a Planned Parenthood clinic in them. And that's our specialty at STOP, actually. We have a plan to defeat Planned Parenthood posted on our website. It's based upon 18 years of fighting Planned Parenthood and many successes around the country. Getting Planned Parenthood kicked out of school systems, getting Planned Parenthood clinics to close, most recently a wonderful battle in Monrovia, California, where pro-lifers were able to get the city to actually buy the Planned Parenthood clinic, brand new abortion clinic in Monrovia, California. The citizens put so much pressure on the city for giving Planned Parenthood permission to build the thing in the first place that the city ended up resolving the issue by buying the Planned Parenthood clinic for over $800,000, and it tore it down. It bulldozed the clinic down in April of 2003 under the guise of redeveloping the whole area. That's a really beautiful victory, and that's due to the people who when the evil came into their town, they mobilized, they prayed, very important thing. They dealt with the issue in prayer, and they peacefully and prayerfully followed the tactics that we recommend. And now they can say, look, because they rose up and they fought this evil in their town, not one baby was aborted at that brand new facility, and the facility is now rubble. It's a dramatic victory, and of course they point to the Lord as being the source of that victory. And some of our victories are not that dramatic. Some of them involve smaller numbers of people. And, of course, in a lot of places, the fight continues on. But you can beat Planned Parenthood at the local level. And if people are interested in finding out more about what they can do, they could visit our website at www.stopinternational.org. Stop is spelled with two P's. And right on the front page, they will see the plan to defeat Planned Parenthood, which is a little booklet-sized thing for free download, and which basically focuses people on what they can do to get Planned Parenthood out of the school systems, how they can defund Planned Parenthood at a local level, and then it also gives a lot of little stories like the one I told about Monrovia that have occurred throughout the United States to give people an idea of how people have done it elsewhere.
If we could, through grassroots and top-down efforts that you have described, completely cut off the siphon that Planned Parenthood has into local money and federal money, what would that do to Planned Parenthood? I mean, back to the kind of bottom line issue.
Well, essentially that would knock out a third of their funding, which is an enormous amount. They could not sustain what they have now under those circumstances. They would either collapse or have to do a radical downsizing. Of course, they do charge people money. Roughly a third of their income is from fees paid by people who go to their clinics and are not subsidized by the government. And then they also get a chunk, 27% roughly, from private contributions and corporations. However, you know, we can work on that third that's coming from the government. We'd be in a great position to see this evil organization begin to collapse in the United States.
Can there also be some strategy to monopolize upon what I imagine is a common situation, and that is, you know, I'm thinking about the town I live in. The city council there, no matter where the citizens or the council stands upon the issue of abortion, an abortion clinic is not the kind of business you want in your town.
Absolutely.
That could be capitalized upon?
Well, it has been in some cases. People have presented studies in Bettendorf, Iowa, for example. They held off a Planned Parenthood clinic for many years because they had a study that the realtors in the area said, look, it's going to be bad for business, bad for housing prices. You're going to have picketers there, and it's not going to be a good thing. That is an approach. In some cases, it might work. In other cases, it might not. But you're absolutely right that it is something that the particular leaders of the community, you should try addressing it through them. I mean, we've had this case in Monrovia where they were able to mobilize, and when I say put pressure on the city, I'm talking about they actually came out in so many numbers to the city council meetings that they couldn't fit them in the chambers. There had to be a big overflow. They educated the community, letters to the editor, literature, prayer services, very important things, a big prayer rally. And then they also put some pressure on the city by filing a lawsuit against the city that charged that the city gave Planned Parenthood preferential treatment in deciding to give Planned Parenthood the permit. In other words, it didn't follow its own rules when it gave Planned Parenthood the permit. So this is the type of legal, peaceful pressure that was put on the city, and the city eventually just, you know, it basically just said, look, we got to get out of this some way, and the most elegant way I think that they could find to get out was they bought the clinic and tore it down.
Let's go to the phones, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Bill is calling from his car. Bill, welcome to Issues Etc.
Thanks. You may have touched on this because I didn't tune in at the beginning of the program, but Planned Parenthood to this day still adheres to Margaret Sanger's doctrine of racial superiority, and Hitler himself used her eugenics principles in his own genocide program. I just got off the phone with Senator Bond's office and explained that fact to them, and they told me they weren't aware of that, and they would relate it to the senator. I'm sure there's a lot that Planned Parenthood's PR people want to keep under the lid, and it might be useful to expose these things, to explain to the community at large that Margaret Sanger was a racist, and they still are racists.
Bill, thank you for the call. Ed, give us a little, for those who aren't in the know on Margaret Sanger, who is Margaret Sanger, and is what Bill contends about her eugenics philosophy true of Planned Parenthood?
Planned Parenthood's founder, Margaret Sanger, basically said in her, I've got her book here, Woman in the New Race, she sums up her philosophy, which is a wedding, basically, of eugenics with birth control. And she says that birth control is nothing more or less than the facilitation of weeding out the unfit, okay? And she said also, and of preventing the births of defectives or those who will become defectives. Now, that's how she started. That eugenics is a very important part of the Planned Parenthood history. And Planned Parenthood is embarrassed in some cases when this is brought up. However, what we see, though, is that Planned Parenthood continues to give awards out in her name. So they can't really have it both ways. I mean, this is a woman who also started a Negro project in the South in the late 30s, along with Dr. Clarence Gamble of Procter & Gamble fame. And she specifically started this to cut down on the number of black babies. And there's a lot of evidence that she's had some links with the KKK, including, and this is very explicit, in her own autobiography, she talks about her speech that she gave to the KKK in New Jersey. and ends it by saying that she was well received enough to the point where she got many other offers. So we can see that these things are in Planned Parenthood, in Margaret Sanger's own writings. When you start to read them, you see that, as the caller said, she was a eugenicist whose philosophy is similar to Hitler's. Now, I have to say that Sanger didn't go as far as saying, well, let's work these people to death and then burn them in ovens, okay? However, she did go as far as saying that the defectives should be rounded up and corralled in these type of, which her description of what she's talking about in her plan for peace is nothing less than a concentration camp. So she did have a lot of similarities in what she was talking about, trying to create this race of thoroughbreds, this superior race, and in her view, it could be done via birth control.
To your knowledge, has Planned Parenthood ever officially disavowed these ideas of Margaret Sanger?
Well, on their website, they do. They kind of gloss it off, and they say, well, you know, there were other people talking about eugenics in that period of time, and of course that's true to some extent. However, I think the main thing that we need to say is, look, this woman's ideas were similar to Hitler's, and there's, you know, we would cringe at anybody giving out awards in Hitler's name. Even if they said, well, we didn't agree with everything he said, but we're going to give these awards out for some other aspect of what he was talking about. And I don't understand how Planned Parenthood can give out awards in Margaret Sanger's name when Margaret Sanger was promoted such an evil idea. They should, if they want to disassociate themselves with Margaret Sanger, which I don't think they do, but if they wanted to clearly do that, then bare minimum they should stop giving out their highest awards which have her name on.
Let's sum this up, if we could, Ed. The abortion business, abortion as a money-making venture, what does it really look like when it comes to Planned Parenthood?
It's a business that is now bringing in about $80 million a year to Planned Parenthood. And the abortion business, of course, is larger than Planned Parenthood. However, Planned Parenthood is now doing about 16% of the abortions in the United States. And as you look at their records, in the 1990s, the number of their abortions continuously was going up every year, except for 94. There was a slight dip there, but it increased. At the same time, abortions all over the country were going down, the records show. So that means that Planned Parenthood was getting a bigger piece of the abortion pie in the United States, and that's what we see, about 16% now. But that doesn't tell the whole story, because Planned Parenthood, although they're the largest abortion clinic in the abortion business in the country, abortion chain, I should say, they do not do most of the abortions. They do 16%. What makes them really so dangerous is that they're at the tip of the spear as far as promoting abortion within our legislatures and within the society at large. So they are the prime promoters of the abortion as well as providers of abortion.
So to defund them, or to attempt to defund them, would not only have the effect of making them less able to provide abortions right there, the real concern, but also make them less able to promote abortion in the public square.
That's right. That's absolutely correct. And the idea that the simple teaching, it's a very teachable moment when you have the government say, we're not going to support a particular group, and the public relations effect of funding being withdrawn from Planned Parenthood has a devastating effect on Planned Parenthood's image. You can see this on a local level, and if we were to get to a point where the federal government would take that step, I think you would see that would be a big blow to Planned Parenthood, just in the public image department as well.
Finally, with only about a minute and a half here, Ed, locally, the Missouri legislature has attempted several times to defund Planned Parenthood in the state of Missouri, some particular monies there, and they've been challenged on several cases, and I think the challenge is still in the courts. Are you aware of this and other state efforts to defund?
Yes. Missouri, there's been an effort in Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, variations of basically applying the Mexico City policy, which is an international policy. It boils down to this. We will not give you our tax dollars. Most cases they're talking about family planning dollars if you provide or promote abortion. That's the Mexico City policy, and that's what states are trying to do. Say, look, you're not going to get our tax dollars if you're doing abortions. It's a simple concept. And it's an idea that really needs to be pushed, and of course it's constitutional. Even though the Supreme Court has claimed that there's a right to abortion in the Constitution, there is no mandate to fund these things or to fund organizations that provide abortions. So you can deal with the funding issue actually separate from the issue of abortion as a whole.
Ed Simkowiak, thank you very much for being our guest, and especially thanks for that last insight that defunding them bears no taint of unconstitutionality. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ed Simkowiak is National Director of Stop Planned Parenthood International, based in Stafford, Virginia. We've been talking about them getting near the $1 billion in revenue mark for abortions alone. If you would like to contact Stop Planned Parenthood International, you can go to their website. It's www.stop, and that's spelled with two P's, international.org, stopinternational.org, or you can call them. Their phone number, area code 540-659-4171. That's area code 540-659-4171. When we come back from this break, we've got open lines for your questions and your comments. I'll read the story from the St. Louis Post-Dispatch about the Catholic elementary school whose teachers would like to unionize. Is this a good idea? What do you think about labor unions? They're a fixture, but the number of people who are members of labor unions has been steadily dropping in the last several decades. Is there anything a Christian compromises by being a member of a labor union? We'll talk about that and other things during Open Lines right after this.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.